Hey, welcome to Transform Your Workplace. It's your host, Brandon Laws. Thanks for the download today. We've got a great show for you. It's brought to you by Zenium HR. Learn more about Zenium's new People Leadership Foundations cohort. We have a spring cohort coming up. It's an 8-week cohort where you get to learn right alongside other aspiring and growing leaders. And it's led by the amazing Susie Weir on Zenium's team. Go learn more about the cohort at zeniumhr.com, links in the show notes. Okay, I'm excited to share today's episode with you. I had a great conversation with Dr. Sandra Upton, the author of the new book, Make It Last, A Roadmap and Practical Strategies for How to Do DEI Work. And just as the title of the book suggests, I think where most employers get DEI wrong is they use it as a tactic and it's a one and done sort of thing, a check the box, so to speak. But what Dr. Upton's book does well is it lays out an entire roadmap for how to implement DEI work and make it part of the culture. Just like any big change inside of an organization, it takes time and it takes a lot of effort to make it stick. So this book really lays it out, and this, especially this conversation, we touch on various areas of the book, and I think you're going to get a really good glimpse into the work that Dr. Upton's doing. Highly recommend getting the book too as a part two to this. So listen to the conversation, but I know you're going to want to go deeper on this. It's really good work. Enjoy today's episode with Dr. Sandra Upton. If you like what you heard, I'd love to hear from you on LinkedIn. A rating and review on Apple Podcasts is great too, but feel free to reach out to me and provide some feedback. I always love to hear how you are liking the show and using this content inside your organization. Enjoy the conversation with Dr. Sandra Upton. Hi, Sandra. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I appreciate the fact that you're talking to me right now. It's 6 p.m. your time. You're in London going on the book tour. Your book, it's called Make It Last, A Roadmap and Practical Strategies for How to Do DEI Work. You released it February 13th, and it sounds like it's just going amazing. So congratulations on the book launch.
Thank you very much.
So early in the book, you said that having a diverse, equitable, and inclusive workforce is not a zero-sum game. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we all are seeing right now is a little bit of backlash, you know, to the work. And part of that backlash is this assumption or myth that if Sandra wins, you know, if we pursue this work and make progress in this work, that it means that Sandra wins and Brandon loses, or Brandon wins and Sandra loses. And that is completely the opposite of the intention behind the work. And if the work is done well, we all win. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of miseducation, misinformation, politics involved in creating that confusion. But I think it's really important for people to understand what DEI is really about and how, again, when we do the work the right way, we all are successful.
I think a lot of organizations are doing some level of DEI work. You had a stat in the book that was kind of shocking. 80% of organizations are going through the motions when it comes to DEI work. So what does that typically look like? I don't know where that stat came from, but it jumped out of the page at me. So maybe unpack that for me.
Yeah. So it was a study that was done recently. And keep in mind that number includes organizations who were part of sort of the mass group of organizations who made a pretty significant commitment after the George Floyd murder, right? So these are organizations who said, oh my gosh, we've got a major problem and we want to really change and do some things differently. And so they put money behind the work and also other forms of support. So fast forward a couple of years later, what we are still seeing is that organizations are still kind of floundering. And again, it's a big part of why I wrote the book, is because I see that organizations are just going through the motions. Even if they are well-intended, you can still be going through the motions. You can be doing what I call activity-based DEI, where, you know, you're just doing a bunch of different things. Doesn't mean that they're bad things, but the question is, you know, are those decisions that you're making related to your actions? Are they data-driven? Are they outcome-driven? Are they moving you in a direction where the needle is really moving and you can anticipate real transformation? And I think, again, that 80%, they are just, a lot of it is the activity-driven work.
Right. And I'm wondering if that is just pure neglect, if they just, maybe they don't know what they don't know. And you alluded to the fact that this is all about change management. I had an expert, an author of a book on change management, come on the podcast, and he walked me through this process. And, you know, in reading your book, it very much seems like a change management process and a strategy. Maybe unpack that for me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the change management research is no stranger. It's been around for many, many years. I studied it in my master's program many years ago, as well as in my doctoral program. We have in front of us this proven framework and this proven evidence-based framework that makes it very clear that if we understand that DEI is all about change, we are simply trying to change behaviors, and we're trying to change systems, and we need to do both. And so if we know that there is a proven framework that will move us in that direction, it made complete sense to me, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel, let's marry that with DEI and help our organizations understand if you take DEI through this change management process. And obviously, as you can see in the book, it's heavily contextualized to DEI. But if we follow these change management steps, we are in a much greater position to make the work last.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you wrote a book on DEI. What was your path leading up to this? Like, did you feel like a book like this was absolutely needed?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been in the DEI space for well over 25 years. And I started out, you know, I talk about this in the book, but I was part of a DEI council, you know, well over 25 years ago. And that's, even if you fast forward to today, a lot of organizations are still structured that way. And that's not a bad thing, as long as those individuals really know what they're doing. But years ago, you know, was part of a DEI council working in a university setting, and back then understood the importance of diversity and the importance of cultural intelligence and inclusion and equity. So it was always a part of just kind of who I am and the way I wanted to help society and organizations. And then that evolved, of course, over the years of working with numerous organizations in the for-profit space, nonprofit government across the globe, hundreds literally over the years, and just, you know, wanting to help move the needle. If you look at the mission on my website, it's, you know, to make the world a more just place, one organization at a time. So long longevity here. But as I have reflected in the last couple of years, because it took me a little over 2 years to write the book, but as I reflected over the years, I just was thinking about what are those key themes and patterns that we keep seeing with organizations, and what can I do? How can I add an additional resource alongside the consulting work that I do and the trainings that I do? What resource can I add to really help try and close that gap between organizations who are just going through the motions and those who are really creating transformation? So that's why I wrote the book. And I think the marriage of a couple of things is what makes the book unique. So one, as you mentioned earlier, it's this idea of DEI, looking at it from a change management perspective. So DEI leaders seeing themselves as change leaders. So not just as the CDO or not just as a council, but we're change leaders. But then the other piece of that is a real solid strategy that is data driven and outcome driven. So that's the second key piece to the book. And then the third piece, which is, I think, the biggest piece, is I think we as thought leaders, as experts in this space, we've done a good job of telling organizations what to do, but not so good of a job of telling them how to do it. And I think that was a huge gap that needed to be closed. And I'm not suggesting I did it perfectly, and I'm not suggesting that other people aren't having those conversations, but I wanted to kind of bring those three pieces together to kind of create this secret sauce that I believe will make all the difference in organizations.
With as long as career you've had in this DEI space, I know you've had some challenges along the way. What are some of those roadblocks that felt like maybe it was an uphill battle along the way?
Sure. You know, there are definitely organizations out there, you know, we hear people talking about DEI is dead, and I completely disagree with that. I do not believe DEI is dead. And part of that, again, comes from the backlash that we are hearing mostly in the U.S. But I think that there are a lot of organizations, you know, when you look at the framework that I outline in the book, it's clear, you know, I tell people, once you read the book, you now are accountable, because you can't unknow what to do, right?
I have to go do something right now.
Right. I've got to do something. So you can't unknow. And so you are not only given what to do, but how to do it every step of the way. But the reality is, so it's a simple 8 steps, but it is a lot of work. A lot of work. And a lot of organizations, you know, if they're talking about their DEI work, they, you know, if you think about those 8 steps, you're like, oh yeah, we're at step 5, we're at step 6, or we're at step 8. But then when they start reading the book and start to really unpack, like, what does it really mean to be at step 5? They're like, well, we probably are at step 1 or 2. So I think part of the roadblock is organizations think they're farther along than they are. And so they skip steps and then they wonder why the work isn't sticking or lasting. And then when they really see how much work is involved, you also discover that they're not as serious as they claimed, right? Because it then requires a significant commitment from the top to the bottom across the organization. So I think those are the things that I see. Organizations think they're farther along, and so they think they can skip around. And we know that you cannot miss steps and think you're going to create real transformation. And also, again, you've still got to do the work at every step of the process.
Yeah. You talk about like a mall map that you, when you first arrive, you're like, you are here. How can organizations figure out where they're at along this continuum?
Yeah, sure. I talk about that in the book too. You know, we talk about this idea of assessing your current state and being honest. And I encourage organizations that there's no shame in being at step 1. What's helpful is just acknowledging that and then building from there versus pretending or assuming that you're farther along and skipping those steps. And so I talk about that at the very beginning of the book to take some time. And so I give them ways to think about, to process that and to say, you know, are you at step 1? And part of the challenging question that I ask after that question is, okay, what's your evidence? So if you really believe you're at step 4 in the process, what is your evidence to confirm that that's true? So that's really the first step. And again, I give them insight around how to process that and then go from there.
I think a challenge most organizations probably face is that whether they have a dedicated DEI position, maybe multiple, or it's a volunteer type of role in an organization, and it probably varies across different sizes of organization, but I'm sure those DEI professionals feel lonely. And you bring up this idea of a DEI council and how that's actually really effective in implementing a DEI strategy. Maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, they can feel lonely. And again, that's where leadership commitment is really important in the work, and leaders really understanding what that means. And you're right, a council can be effective, assuming, so that's a qualified statement, assuming, again, they are structured properly and you develop the necessary skills and competence. Because my experience, you know, again, I shared my own personal experience. Years ago, we formed a council. We were all incredibly passionate about the work. We represented a wide range of disciplines and departments across the university, but we failed. Because we were passionate, but we didn't have the competence. I probably had the, maybe me and one other person had probably the most competence, but overall, we did not have the skills to move or the resources and support to move the work forward. And so I think it's really important that leadership, I'm talking top CEO, C-suite, that they understand that there has to be support for that role, whether it's a CDO or whether it's a manager or if it falls under the CHRO or a council, they understand that they have to communicate across the organization that while this individual or this group is providing strategic leadership for the work, it's the responsibility is on all of us. And so part of that includes helping people understand that they have to share in the work and upskilling them, right, with the tools and competence that they need to help support the work in a productive way.
You said that DEI work can be mentally draining at times, and you offer some suggestions for how to protect your mental health. What are some of those ideas that you had?
Yeah. In fact, I suggest, especially those who are, again, the strategic leaders in the work, that before you finalize or update or revise your strategy or create your strategy for how you're going to move the organization forward, to literally develop a formal strategy for protecting your mental health. And I talk about the importance of internal strategies and external strategies. So simple, common examples of external strategies would be, you know, things like getting your rest, and exercising and eating healthy and doing things that you love, you know, having a wonderful community of friends, but also mentors and sponsors, even external to the organization. So those are some examples of things that you can do outside of the organization that are really important to keeping you mentally strong. And then internally, one of the really important things that you should do, especially if you are the lone ranger in the work in terms of providing that strategic leadership, is establishing boundaries and clear expectations. And so when you think about what a strategy might look like, typically when I'm working with organizations, we start with a 1 to 2 year strategy, set realistic goals and set realistic expectations around what people can expect from you. If you're the only one leading the work, everybody comes to you for everything. And so what might be some boundaries that you can set to say, yeah, I can help you with this, but this part, you actually need to do your own learning around this. So setting boundaries, setting clear expectations around what should be expected within X time frame are, I think, two really important strategies that can be a part of that overall mental health plan.
You had a table in the book around the allyship continuum that I thought was pretty interesting. And it felt like for individuals, this is probably more of a self-awareness check on where people are at in the continuum. Maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, there are five different steps, you know, and I will, you know, talk about sort of the ideal place. A lot of people misunderstand the role of ally, and that is a very active role. So that final state of allyship, you know, if you start at the beginning, it's this idea of you think you're an ally, you know, because you're like, I don't have anything against this work. I think it's a good idea and I love everybody, right?
They're just not doing anything about it.
Not doing anything, right? And then let's go all the way to the opposite where, again, you really do see yourself as someone that is committed to using their social agency to really come alongside and even get in front of others, particularly those who are from underrepresented or marginalized groups, and play a very key role in helping to close gaps and disband those disparities and, you know, be on the lookout for microaggressions and biases and play an active role. An example that I will give sometimes is, you know, back at home, the community that I live in, it's a predominantly white community. And if you were to walk around my neighborhood, you know, there would be no shortage of Black Lives Matter signs in yards. And I think it's great. I think it's a great sign of solidarity. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But oftentimes I'm tempted to go up and knock on the door and say, I think that sign is wonderful, but help me understand, like, what does that actually look like in your life? So if I were to come to your work, would I see African-Americans in leadership roles? Who do you do business with, both at work? You have a diversity supplier program where you can say you are providing economic equity to Black businesses. Do you personally, do you have a Black doctor? Who does your landscaping? So that's where the rubber meets the road. And that's where that final stage of allyship is. You are actively, proactively working to close those gaps and demonstrating it through some of the examples that I just shared.
You said that people starting out in this journey shouldn't skip the steps. And in the book, you outline all the steps, and we're going to touch on some of that today. People will feel pressure to produce something immediately, and that's probably why they want to skip the steps. Why is that not a good idea?
It's not a good idea because, again, we know based on the research around change management, we know what's required to make the change last. And yep. So if you want to do things that make you feel good or feel like, you know, we are making progress, understand that, again, if you skip those steps, that work is going to be limited and it won't be sustainable. And so if it's interesting, when you think about those 8 steps, and I know you said we'll get into them more later, but you think about step 3 in terms of the developing the strategy, you know, there's 2 things you need to do before you even do that part, right? So that tells you the work. And then there are, once you develop your strategy, there are 5 things you still need to do after you develop the strategy. So people either want to jump straight to the strategy and not think about buy-in, not think about their how they're going to organize the work. And then when they were done with the strategy, they do an awful job of communicating it and things fall apart. They do an awful job of building these superheroes so the work gets shared and you can scale the work. So if they skip step 3 and they assume that they can jump to 8 and now all of a sudden DEI is going to be part of the DNA of the organization, that is not going to be a reality for that organization.
Seems like the first stage would be like getting the buy-in initially. And is there a percentage of people that really need to be bought in to affect change? I don't know if there's like a magic number. It seems like it would need to be everybody, but is that realistic or not?
Yeah, it should, ideally, you know, it's everybody, but there is, again, some research when in the change management work. And specifically, you can see that I pulled from the amazing work that John Cotter at Harvard has done for many, many years. And so he does, and his research gives us some guidelines around ways, some benchmarks to at least think about what's a sufficient amount of support to feel like you've got what you need to really create momentum and move the needle. And so ideally, you want at least 100% commitment at the top. So that's CEO, C-suite. And then if you come down and think about middle managers in the organization, you want at least 75. And then when you think about the rest of the organization, you want the majority of those individuals to be bought into the work. Now, again, ideally, we want 100% at every level, but that's not realistic. But those are at least benchmarks to be able to say, okay, if we know we've got 100% at the top, at least 75% in the middle, and most of the people beneath that, we have enough, you know, commitment to really create real change. And it doesn't mean, again, that we ignore that 25%. I call it the sticky middle, right? So there is value in, you know, trying to understand why those folks are not in support of the work and, you know, give some energy to try and close that gap and pull them along. But I talk a lot in the book about resistors. And I also talk about the, it's really important to understand that while they matter, they don't matter the most. And that's because you can easily spend all of your energy on that 25%, not focus on the majority. So it's, again, it's a balance of not ignoring, because people resist for lots of different reasons. We know some of the common ones that people don't like to give up power or control, or they think, again, it's a zero-sum game. They're scared. But there are lots of other reasons. So I commit a whole chapter in the back on why people resist, what's the psychology behind that, and then what are some things we can attempt to do to bring them along. But at some point, we have to manage how much energy we give them and realize that they matter again, but they don't matter the most.
So once we got buy-in, we're ready to move forward. How do we propel action forward into the next step?
Yeah. So that second step in the process is, again, assuming we've got the buy-in and using those benchmark numbers that I just shared. Then again, before we even focus on the strategy, we need to determine how we're going to get the work done. And if we do that right, it then minimizes some of the things that you talked about earlier. It minimizes the stress and mental health of the person who is providing strategic leadership. It positions you to be able to scale the work appropriately. And so what we argue in that second step is this idea of creating a governance structure. And that can look a lot of different ways for a lot of different organizations, depending on where they are in the journey. But it should include, obviously, the core group or the individual that's doing the work. Oftentimes, it might be the council, the DEI council. And then one of my recommended best practices is an executive council, and that's top leadership in their team. And the reason that that's so important is because, again, leaders, even if they're committed to the work, they don't know what that really means in terms of demonstrating that commitment. And so to help them really understand how important that is, the more you can formalize their role in the work and then upskill them to be able to lead that effectively, those are critical things. And it's not overnight necessarily, and it's not super easy, but part of, again, why top leaders resist, or they aren't doing the job that they should be doing in terms of helping to lead the work, is they don't know what to do or how to do it, right? And so formalizing an executive council, and then typically when I'm working with organizations, then I spend time upskilling them. Like this is literally what this looks like. This is how you lead this work as an executive council. So that upskilling piece is important, because understand that they are not experts in DEI.
Right. When forming that DEI council or tribe, as you call it in the book, I imagine it could fall apart if there's not specific roles defined and like very clear actions for those different types of people. What roles do you recommend on this group?
Yeah. And again, it depends on the organization, right? So I think all of those decisions along these eight steps should always be data driven, right? So if you go back, if you've done the right work in steps one or in step one, and you've done that assessment, right? So part of asking where we are on the continuum also includes doing some kind of assessment to understand what are your greatest opportunities as an organization? You know, is our issue that we are not attracting diverse talent? Or is the issue, yes, we're actually doing a good job, but then we're losing all of the people of color or women because they're not feeling a sense of belonging or they're not feeling like they're getting promoted. So that earlier homework around assessing your current state includes looking at where are the greatest gaps and opportunities, and that should inform your structure. So let's say you have those issues, then part of your structure might be you've got your DEI council, you've got your executive council, but then you might form some employee resource groups that are focused on women or people of color, which with the idea of emphasizing employee engagement or retention, right? So, but that is directly decided by the data that you learned about yourself in step one. So,
and I imagine the data informs the plan. In that whole chapter you have about mapping the plan, you talk about making sure that it aligns with the overall business strategy. How do we do that?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, again, where top leadership plays such a key role, right? And that's where, you know, if you think about that executive council CEO and his C-suite, his or her, their C-suite, part of that is them taking ownership for determining the mission and vision for the work. That is the responsibility of the CEO. What is your vision? Just like you have a vision for the company in terms of here's where we're trying to go and who's, this is who we want to be, you know, as a, that responsibility falls to the top. And so once the CEO and that executive committee has determined the overall vision, then they should also be having conversations around how that fits into the business strategy. So those are happening concurrently. So those conversations are happening, should be happening at the top and certainly in collaboration with whoever is providing strategic leadership for the work. But that's how you start the work there. And again, yeah, if you're having the right conversations, then you'll immediately be sure to connect those dots early on. And then you just build out from that as you begin to develop the DEI strategy.
The DEI council probably shouldn't be making all sorts of decisions and just keeping those things in a vacuum. We should be communicating that outward to the organization, right? Like, where are we in this plan? We should communicate the plan, where we're at. How do we do that? Like, what's the right methodology around communication? How often should we do it?
Yep. So that's step four in the process. And that's a great question because, you know, when you talk about some of the barriers and biggest issues, I cannot tell you how many organizations I have worked with that have, again, done a pretty decent job of putting together a strategy, but they've done a horrible job of communicating it. And so, and they get so frustrated because, you know, let's say they do an employee engagement survey or a pulse survey or something related to DEI. And then it comes back and employees are like, we have a DEI council? I didn't know we had one. Oh, we're doing that? Oh, I had no clue. And leadership, they're like, oh my gosh, but we're doing this, 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 and that. And so that's a communications issue. So again, in that step four, I outline lots of things that you can do and how to do those. And so it's this constant stream of communication. You cannot over communicate. It has to come from those who are providing strategic leadership as well as from the top. And so that can include a whole host of things. And that communication not only includes putting the information out there, but creating a feedback loop to get people's input on a regular basis. So town hall meetings, you know, doing those surveys, they certainly can be helpful. But then communicating using every communication vehicle that you have in the organization, whether that's the intranet, again, or if there are team meetings or town hall meetings, but every platform that you use to communicate all of the other things that you want employees to know and understand, use those same ones and do it on repeat. And just know that you can never over communicate. It's a good problem if people are complaining that every time I turn around, I'm hearing about this DEI stuff. That's a good problem.
This next question, we could probably spend an entire like hour on this part. So maybe just give me the high levels. What are like the key areas to address in a culture to make a lasting change in this space? Like example, like policies, procedures, how we interview people, like what are your suggestions?
It has to be to create that real change. Again, it has to be a combination of strategies that impact behavior change and system change. And again, you have to step back and do that assessment to know where are your greatest opportunities. And oftentimes you'll find that there are lots of opportunities. And so then you have to use the data to inform how do we prioritize those things, right? Where are we getting the greatest feedback? So if we know that retention is an issue, a big issue for us, but we're also having a problem with, you know, people, certain culture groups feeling a sense of belonging. So go back to your data, right? And what data is the loudest around these issues? And you start there. So you don't feel like you have to do everything at once, but you then identify, I always recommend maybe 2 to 3 areas of focus and then build out an actual strategy for each of those things. So I think, again, it's coming back, getting focused on those areas. Once you determine what those areas are, prioritize what actions need to be connected to that. And then from there, it's incredibly important if you're going to, again, create the real change, every action that you determine must have a metric tied to it. If you can't tie a metric to it, then don't waste your time. Every action. And then part of it is, and then looking at, based on this action and the metric, what change does it create? Does it create change at the behavior level, or does it create change at the system level, or both? So I think that's how you really begin to penetrate the culture and know that it's working when you are building solid metrics tied to the progress.
If the DEI Council gains a lot of momentum on their strategy, it's working, you can see change is starting to happen in the organization. Will there come a time in the strategy where running it strictly through a volunteer group of allies, the council is enough? Like, do we need to hire a paid position for somebody to own this? Like, I'm sure it varies based on size of organization, but what's your experience with that?
Yeah, the ideal scenario is always to think about moving towards a paid position. And I talk about that once you get to typically like step 6 in the process, which is about creating short-term wins and planning for those wins, because people, that's a big piece that people, part of keeping the momentum and keeping people engaged is they need to see that it's working. They need to see that there is progress. But also part of that is usually a good time when you're starting to see those wins, you go to that step 7. And we call this the idea of the snowball effect, right? So you begin to get that great momentum. Now let's build off of that. But that's usually the time when a lot of good progress has been made. And now we're trying to go to the next level. And you really do need to allocate more resources, not pull back. But that might be the time, okay, the council has served its purpose, but we need to hire a CDO right now. Or we need to hire a DEI director right now and allocate the necessary resources and make sure that they have the support that they need from the top to take things to the next level. So always be thinking about, and even when we get to step 8, we talk about the idea of succession planning. And that means, you know, when you think about who's carrying the load or providing leadership for the work, what is the succession plan so that those people or that individual doesn't burn out, right? Are we building a good team around them? Are we thinking about what's the next step when this person is no longer able to do the work? Or again, you need to expand the team. So that succession planning is really critical as you get into step 7 and ultimately step 8.
Yeah, it seems like that would be the key to making sure this doesn't become a short-term initiative into a lasting, like, you might have a plan for a couple of years, like, here's what we want to accomplish and that here's our mission for the next couple of years, but this needs to be ongoing. And the succession planning piece probably is the most important, because you don't want that council to die off. You need people coming in and out, making sure that the roles and responsibilities are there. And I mean, in your experience, is that true?
Unfortunately, it doesn't happen like it should. You know, what I see often is they want to keep the council going forever and ever and ever. And that's not sustainable, because if you're doing the work the right way, it's not going to lighten up. It's going to become more, because you really are going to see all of what's involved in truly creating this culture where DEI is at its core and it's part of the DNA. It's not like the work is going to get less. It's going to, you know, it's no different than you're never going to get rid of your sales team, right? If anything, as the company is growing, as the company, you're going to expand your sales team probably. You're going to expand roles in those different departments as part of the growth. Why would DEI be any different? So at some point it will outpace a volunteer role. And usually I say that shouldn't, probably best for that to happen sooner rather than later. A lot of organizations that are using as part of their governance structure, the council or committee, whatever they are choosing to call it, but that should not be a long-term solution to the work. And when it is, that speaks to commitment as well, or lack of.
The council to me seems like a stair-step approach to ingraining it inside the DNA of the culture. And I swear there was a nugget in your book somewhere. Maybe I was just thinking that it would be a good idea, but in the interview process, maybe incorporating some DEI focused questions so that you know that the people you're hiring are already aligned with the DEI strategy that the organization has bought into.
100%, 100%. When you think about the employee life cycle, right? DEI should be fully ingrained in every step of that process. So starting with the hiring and onboarding process to promotion and development to just the day-to-day interactions across cultures within the organization. Every step of the process should be vetted. And what I mean by that is you should be vetting the processes. So when you talk about hiring, you know, are we making sure that our processes are not biased? Are we making sure that the people who are making decisions, that they've gone through unconscious bias training? So there's a whole learning and development piece to this work. And also, as you were suggesting, making sure that, you know, again, you're looking at those systems and you're looking at those behaviors, but then you're also communicating to that incoming employee that this is a core value of ours here. And it's important for us to make sure that you support that value. So asking questions around what are your thoughts about D&I, and you know, how do you feel about being a part of an organization? What have you done in previous organizations to be an ally for the work? So those are very appropriate questions to really help not only to make it clear that this is an expectation, that this is who we are as part of our core values, but there is also an expectation that you are going to share in the responsibility for making sure that this work lasts in our organization.
Sandra, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I kept you a lot longer than I told you I would. But this is such a great conversation. And I want to point people back to the book. So it's called Make It Last, A Roadmap and Practical Strategies for How to Do DEI Work. At the back of the book, you've got a glossary of definitions, a list of commonly used acronyms in DEI, and an extensive reading list on this subject. People should go check that out too. It's just like, it's got everything in one book, the full roadmap. So if people want to make a change in their organization, this is a good place to start. Where can people learn more about you? I don't know if you want to allow people to connect with you on LinkedIn or anything like that, but please point people to what do you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of ways that you can connect with me. So I am most active on LinkedIn. So that's if you type in Dr. Sandra Upton, you'll find me there. You certainly can go to my website and learn a lot more about the work that we do. The book is a new resource, but we also provide consulting and learning and development with organizations all over the world. And so that website address is www.uptonconsultinggroup.com. And then if you want to just reach out to me directly, you can do that at sandra.upton@uptonconsultinggroup.com. So, and then the book can be purchased on Amazon or anywhere books are sold.
My guest today has been Dr. Sandra Upton. Thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning in for today's episode of Transform Your Workplace. The content on this show is strictly for general information and educational purposes only, so that you can go transform your workplace in a positive way. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed on the show are the guest's own and don't represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of either Zenium HR, the sponsor of the show, or me, the host, Brandon Laws. Additionally, Zenium HR or myself, Brandon Laws, doesn't endorse any guest, their business, or any organization they represent. So discretion is advised. We encourage you to work with a trusted advisor to find a custom approach that fits your organization's needs. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode.